And now, I'd like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Lisa from San Diego.
Hi, everybody. My name's Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is October 10, 1986. I intend to stay sober until October 10, 2008, and that will mean that I will have been sober as long as I drank. I'm delighted to be here, and thank you for inviting me. I found out I was going to do this on, I'm kind of the default speaker, I think. I found out I was going to do this on New Year's Day, in between the opera and the symphony. And I got this big pit in this set, you know, and this, you know, that scared feeling in my stomach. And then I thought, well, it's an opportunity to be of service. And so that's what I'm going to try to do. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't like myself. I didn't realize it, but I didn't like myself very much, and if at all. And that's changed completely. And I'll try to tell you how that happened. I have a lot of, well, we all, you know, what we do here is share our experience, strength, and hope. I think we all come here with a lot of experience. I probably, most of you have some, and what I will share with you about my story may shock you, probably won't shock you, but I'm shocked because I'm here telling you. Because I didn't talk about anything before I got here. So that's a big change. When I was new, I heard people say, listen for the similarities, not the differences. And then I heard somebody say, an old timer, a guy with like 35 years of sobriety, said, listen for the differences. Just keep coming back. Just listen. So whatever you want to listen for, you know, I'm a little worried that I might, you know, I never expected to live this long and to be this old, and sometimes I get forgetful. So what I did was bring my big book, and I see you have one here, large print too. In case I have major brain fade, I can just read for 45 minutes, and it will be time well spent. My story is in here, all through here, so it wouldn't matter, really. But anyway, I'll tell you. I'll try to tell you the story. I was born in Alaska to parents who didn't think they could have children. And we lived on an island. After I got sober, I found out that my father was an alcoholic and had stopped drinking by joining a religion that didn't drink. It was before, that was a long time ago. I told you I'm old. It was before Alcoholics Anonymous, but he found a way to get sober. And his way is not much different than our way, and that is through finding a connection with the power greater than ourselves. And we lived on an island, and there was no alcohol around, and we made our own entertainment, and I lived a really unbelievably idyllic, beautiful life. We made, you know, we were happy. My parents were happy to have me, and I lived a really sheltered, protected, perfect life. My father would read to me, my mother would play the piano, and we'd sing, make music together. We'd have home movies. We had relatives who lived on the same island with us, three of my uncles and their families. It was kind of like Little House on the Prairie, I guess. And I'll try not to say "anda" too much. Public speaking. Love it. When I was three, my parents told me they needed to talk to me about something, and we sat around the little stove, and they said that I was going to they told me that I was going to have baby brother or a baby sister. And they also told me that they brought me up to believe that if I was a good girl and I prayed to God, God would give me what I asked for. So I prayed every night for a sister, and when my brother was born, I started becoming agnostic. And I stopped trusting God. And from the time that happened until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I went in the opposite direction of God from then on. When I was 5 years old, not quite six, I was waiting for my father was a logger, and he would take a boat to work every day. We went everywhere by boat and plane. It was before Alaska was a state, and there weren't roads up there, so we went everywhere by boat. And he went to work one day, and I remember seeing him leave and wink at my mom as he went to work. And we were waiting to have lunch, and one of the wives of one of the crew or the other loggers came into the house in hysterics, and she said, "The boat's capsized. The boat's capsized." And I didn't know what that meant, but I found out later that God had other plans for my father, and he never came home. We never found him, and so he was lost at sea. And then I really started to hate God, because I was no longer important to God. And that was kind of the way I lived my life. I did a lot of isolating. I think I began not only to hate God, but to hate people. So I isolated a lot as a child. We moved to California when I was in second grade, and that's where my parents had lived when they were first married. And I was sent to parochial school. And when we got a television, I thought that was the greatest thing, because I could escape into television. And I would just isolate and live in a fantasy world. And I hated my mother, because she needed me so much. And I hated God, and I hated my mother. So I would fantasize about my mother passing away and somebody else adopting me. And that never happened. But when I was I just finished high school, I got my first taste of alcohol. And I don't think I had enough the first time I tasted it, but the second time I tasted it, I found myself feeling better than I'd ever felt in my life. It was like the solution to all my problems. And I kind of started to like people a little bit, I thought. And I wanted to get away from my mom, so I moved in with a distant cousin who had... she was older than I was. She was actually a registered nurse. And we got to have cocktails every day. And she worked for an internist, and we had, she taught me how to self-medicate with, she got a lot of samples of, she worked for an internist, and we had quart jars full of uppers and downers and everything you can, birth control pills, whatever you needed. And, they were all in the linen closet. And instead of sheets and towels, we had pills and alcohol. And she said to me, Make sense to me. It was magic. It was just the best thing. And I was finally I'm so happy. You know, all of a sudden, my life just turned around. It was the answer to everything. And she said to me, she said, Lisa, I've worked in emergency rooms, and I've worked in intensive care units, and I've seen people die from drinking. And that's what's going to happen to you if you don't slow down. I remember she said that. And so I moved out. You know, I couldn't live like that. I had to go somewhere else. So, you know, she was trying to control my drinking, and I wasn't going to have any of that. So I went away to college. And I didn't learn very much in college. And I didn't finish college. When I was living with her, I had developed a long-distance relationship with a fellow who was in the United States Air Force, stationed in Germany. And we wrote back and forth, and he was kind of entertaining. He saw a picture of me that she had sent to her ex-boyfriend. And so when he came back to the States, he got stationed in California, and I met him on Christmas vacation. And then my mother had been reading his letters, and she told me never to have anything to do with him. So in spring vacation, I married him. And then I got pregnant, and I gave birth to a little boy, and it was actually a big boy. He's my chauffeur tonight. He drove me here tonight. And I remember thinking, looking in wonderment at this baby and thinking, maybe there is a God. You know, that beautiful child that I really did not have anything to do with making. It just happened, you know. And it was so, and he was so perfect and so sweet and needed me so much. And I was a terrible parent. I mean, I did the best I could, but from the time I started drinking, my highest priority was, that's what it was, drinking. And my husband loved to drink as much as I did. And he was 6'3", and he could drink. Boy, could he drink. I think it was teacher's scotch. And later, we had some great fun on gin gimlets, and I really liked hanging out with him because he had two refrigerators, one for a keg and one for the other stuff. So we drank a lot. That's what we did. And we got custody of his daughter from his first marriage. And we never had any alcohol at home because we drank so much. So I got left at home with the kids a lot. And I got some big resentments. And so I figured he was a problem. So I divorced him. And I remember when he took me back to my mom's house with the kids. The marriage wasn't working out, so I had another kid. So I had two. little girl. And we moved back to the town where my mom lives, and I went to work, and it was really hard being a single parent, so I found another man to marry, who also liked to drink, and he was in law enforcement, so it kind of curtailed my drug use. And you know how those kinds of relationships go. When you drink, it's very stormy, and there was a lot of abuse. And we were married for I think 9 years, and when we finally got divorced, he was such a good looking man. He was just, you know, this dream come true. Well, I wasn't the only one who knew that or thought so. He was a cutie pie. And so what I did when I was married to him was make sure that he wasn't one up on me. You know, he always had a girlfriend, I always had a boyfriend. And that's what we did. And it was, you know, it never occurred to me to say, I'm married to you, I expect you to be faithful to me. Never crossed my mind. So I divorced him, and I thought my life was good. The kids and I thought it was going to be really peaceful, but I was the problem. And, you know, I went wild then. It was by the time I divorced that man, I was not able to drink like I used to drink. I would get drunk on one beer and a couple hits off the joint. And so I learned about, I had a brother too who, I told you about my brother. He was, he was a great source of illegal supplements to my drinking. So he got sober and that kind of messed up things for me. And I saw him change. I saw him go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I used to sit up at the bar and say, he's weak. He's so weak, he needs those meetings. And the whole time I was drinking, my whole life, I really believed that I could control it and that I was doing it because I wanted to. I didn't realize that I didn't have a choice. I didn't realize I didn't have a choice until after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So what happened was, when I got divorced from my second husband, I had a $20,000 check for a settlement from the divorce, and I took it to my bank, and I filled out a deposit slip, and I put it in my checking account. And I remember the teller looking kind of sideways at me. She said, are you sure you want to put this all in your checking account? And I said, oh, yeah. And that $20,000 was gone in 6 weeks. And I was broke. So I had to economize and go to the less expensive white powder. And, I always could play the victim, and I always had two jobs. I went to work for the state of California in 1972 because I needed health insurance for my kids. It was a very smart thing to do. I did not want to do it, but it was my mother's idea, and I'm glad I took her advice because I got a job, and I actually was very high functioning. I went to school and worked and drank. You know, when you're young, you can do so much. And, I just kept things going, and I kept getting promotions the first 7 years I worked for the state of California. Of course, we know what state employees do. They're flaky, right? I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I didn't have a bottle in my purse, but I would go to coffee break to a bar and drink Irish coffee and think nothing of it. So, anyway, this disease takes us in a downward spiral. And my downward spiral took me to Bob's Club in Elk Grove, California. And in Bob's Club, I met a whole bunch of people just like us, only they weren't in recovery. And they were all clearly, probably addicted to alcohol and some other things. It was the kind of place where they were shooting pool in the bar, shooting drugs in the bathroom, and shooting each other in the parking lot. Really? Yeah. Yeah. And I went to work there. You know, it's like I never could make enough money, so I had to go to work in the bar. And it was one of those places where they had a relationship with the ABC, so you could drink all the time while you were working. And my kids kind of worried about me at that point. In fact, they were pretty disgusted with me. That's where I met the man who became my third husband. Well, you know, he was he was a biker, but he didn't have a bike. He had a tattoo of one. And I really liked him because he knew everybody in Sacramento and the surrounding counties who was a cooker. Does anybody know what a cooker is? Oh, you know. Yeah, it's another program. Another program. And he loved me so much. He loved me so much, he wanted to know what I was thinking every minute of the day. And he would ask me. He would pick me up. He was always very prompt, too. He would drive my car all day, and he would be right at the curb when I got off work at 5 o'clock. And if I wasn't at the curb at 5 o'clock, he was sure I was doing the wild thing with somebody in the office. And I think I may have a part in that, even though I wasn't doing the wild thing with anybody in the office. But when we would be up all night, I used to have these acrylic nails, and I would take them off, and then I'd put them back on. And supplement that with, you know, all night long, and drinking tequila and beer and whatever else, and never eating and using these other substances. And I thought I had the mysteries of the universe figured out while I was taking my fingernails off and putting them back on. And this guy who loved me would be sitting there watching me, waiting for me to send him out to get some more or whatever, and give him some money to do that. And he would ask me questions. And I didn't know that I could say, I'm not going to answer that question. So basically what I did with that man, probably, was when I got sober, I found out, was a fist up in advance. You know, I just told him anything he wanted to know. So no wonder he was insecure. Because I told him everything I ever did. So we were trying to play like we were normal, and I had abandoned my children because they were interfering with my drinking. I really decided that they were abused. I believed that my children were abusing me because they didn't like the people I was hanging out with. They were pretty scary. So I had moved out. I went home one day and I told my kids, this is the worst, I think the worst thing I could have ever done. And I'm living amends for it the rest of my life. I went home and I said, I'm moving out. You guys are going to have to find another place to live. And that's what I did. And so I was living with this guy. I had a lot of interesting characters in my life, and they kind of all faded away when this guy came into my life and took me hostage, and I volunteered. You know, I was safe, and I had my drugs. And you would think I'd be happy. You would think, you know, all the drugs I want, all the alcohol I want, and somebody who really loves me. I was miserable. And so we were going to be normal, and I reconciled with my daughter a little bit, and I was going to take her to Disneyland, and my husband went to get some supplies for the trip, and I went to work, and he called me on the phone, and he said, I just wrecked your car. And I thought he was fooling with me. I thought he was trying to get my, jerk my chain, because he was always doing that. And I said, if you didn't, you better burn it, because I never want to see you in the car or the car again. I just wanted him out of my life. And I thought, then I was going to be okay. Well, it turns out he really did wreck the car. And he was on probation, and so he was going to be in trouble. So he went into hiding, and I started getting, this is what got me sober. So great. I started getting telephone calls from, he had a head-on collision with somebody, and there was a child in the other car. And I was worried, you know, that I was going to not be looking so good, because I couldn't tell these people who were calling me where my car was, because I told them not to bring it back. So what happened was I decided to pretend that my car had been stolen, and the police are really smart. You can't fool them. So that didn't work. So then I thought, I was really scared. I thought, because this guy had some you know, he had some friends who were very, very scary from, you know, they'd been in prison and they were doing armed robberies and they were running guns and drugs and a nice girl like me with this crowd. So I called his probation officer and she said, Lisa, I've seen a picture of you and I can't figure out what a girl like you is doing with a guy like that. And I said, oh, I feel sorry for him. And she said, are you afraid of him? I said, yeah. She said, I think maybe you should call Women's Shelter and talk to the counselor there. And I was willing to do that. And when I called the Women's Shelter, the counselor there was really smart. And she said to me, is there any alcohol or drug use in your home? And I was still into being hip, slick, and cool, and I said, oh, yeah. There is. Sure. We do that. She said, I had a flirtation a year and a half before. It's funny how we kind of get into recovery and somebody gives us a big book, and then we think we can control it, and we don't really do anything that's, what I did was I didn't do anything that suggested I got 110 days clean, and then I went out to dinner with some other guy who was, you know, probably the best catch in that in Bob's Club. He was a truck driver. He took me out to dinner and he said, this was when I had 110 days clean and I wasn't drinking either. And it was a place called Al the Wops in Locke, California. And you have to walk through the bar to get to the food. And he said, how about let's have a drink before dinner? And I thought to myself, I looked up at all those dollar bills on the ceiling, and I thought, I have been so good. I deserve it. And I went on another, that year and a half that just before I got to AA was, you know, the worst. Remember, I tried not to use. I just tried to drink, and I can't do, for me, it's like part of my story. You know, I just couldn't leave one alone and use the other. I just couldn't drink like I used to. So I lost my train of thought. The women's shelter. I went to the women's shelter and I didn't have a car. I forget how I got there. But they suggested that I start, the counselor suggested that I start going to 12-step meetings, and my daughter was eavesdropping on the telephone extension, and she came out of the bedroom and she said, Mom, you've been using, you gotta go to those meetings today. And I was willing, and I went. I started going to meetings, and I remember when I was hungover one time, I was talking to my brother who was sober, and he said, you know, Lisa, every time I talk to you, you have a hangover. Maybe you ought to think about trying 90 meetings in 90 days. And he never said one more word to me about it. But when I was ready, I remembered that. And I started going to a meeting every day. And I'm spending way too much time on what happened. But what happened, I mean, the recovery part is really the most exciting part. I was willing. I was given the gift of willingness, even though I didn't think I belonged here. I'd come to meetings and I'd say, my name's Lisa, I'm an addict. And everybody go, keep coming back. And eventually, it didn't take too long, I began to hear people talk about how they felt, and I could really relate. I was no longer, you know, it was like I wasn't in isolation anymore. I started to come out of isolation. And I started to feel like I belonged, and I got a pink cloud, and I wanted to be here, and I kept going to meetings, and I kept running into this woman named Becky, and Becky would, every time I'd see Becky, she'd say, she had 5 years of sobriety. I thought that was so long, and it was, you know, it really is a long time. And she said, have you got a sponsor? So finally I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said, oh no honey, I'm already sponsoring 18 people asked Donna to be your sponsor. So I asked Donna to be my sponsor. Donna and I could not, our schedules didn't coincide. So I ran into Becky again. She said, "What step are you on?" Not on any step. She said, "Well, you need to fire Donna and ask Sharon to be your sponsor." And I'm, a real people pleaser, codependent. I don't want to do that. But I was willing, so I did. And I asked Sharon to be my sponsor. And Sharon took me through the steps. And she taught me. She told me if I didn't go to the Big Book seminar, she wouldn't sponsor me. So I went, and I learned about, the principles and the steps, and how Bill and Bob made this all happen, and what they meant when they wrote the Big Book and the 12 and 12. And that I was powerless. When I first got sober, I wanted to go right to the fourth step because I thought that would fix me. It's kind of like self-help. And Sharon made me start with step one and look at my drinking honestly. And when I started reading what I had written in the first step, I started to cry. And she said, "Lisa, normal people don't drink like that. That's abnormal drinking. We don't drink. Normal people, when you give them a drink and then you give them another drink and they say, 'No, thank you, I'm starting to feel it,' I just say, 'Keep it coming.'" And if I ever forget, I come to meetings so I won't forget. All I have to do is ask my kids. They remember. I remember when I was miserable if I wasn't drinking. I think my daughter was about 8 years old, and she said, "Mom, I was trying to go on a diet and not drink." She said, "Could I please make you a martini?" That was not fun to be around. And I think I'm easier to be around today. I didn't like the whole idea of having to say prayer. I remember I get really nauseous when you guys would be saying the Lord's Prayer. I wanted to run. And I went to a step study, and I heard somebody say, "You can just start over with a clean slate and forget everything you ever knew about God or what you thought you knew, and you get to choose. Your concept of a higher power can be anything. It's not an obstacle for you to be an agnostic. You can be here. Just keep coming back." That's the most important thing I ever heard. Just keep coming back. And I got to turn my life and my will over to the care of God. I didn't know what that is. But I do that every day now. And I got to write that fourth step. It was a whole book full of shit. Oh. I wasn't going to use the shit word. I got all the way through the steps. I had to pay back some money. Most of my, and I did it anonymously. But, money orders work, and you just send them, and it's done. I don't recommend doing amends without talking to your sponsor or some spiritual advisor. I'm a work in progress. There's so many. I'm rushing now because I want to get. Fiona's looking at her watch. I've done a lot of living in the last 21 years since I got sober. I had, after Sharon was my sponsor, I had a sponsor for a while who taught me that the most memorable thing she said was, and it came in handy later, and she said, I used to hear her say, "Don't kill yourself in the first 5 years because you won't know who you killed." And then I had a sponsor who, I had a man sponsor. I had a rebellious nature, if you didn't already notice. And, they always say women work with women and men work with men, and so I wanted a man sponsor. And his name was Richard, and Richard sponsored a lot of people. And he taught me how to do relationships. I'm still learning that. And he said he learned how to, he didn't call it sponsorship, he called it partnership. And he said, The way we do this, we learn how to have relationships, is we share our imperfections and we don't practice our character defects on each other. And one day Richard called me and he said, how'd you like to make, I was about 3 years sober, and he said, how'd you like to make a commitment to 6 months of continuous sobriety? And he took me to the mental health facility in Sacramento where I got sober. And into the place where they 5150 people. And that means that you go there, if you haven't been there, it's a place where it's a 5150 is a section of the Welfare and Institutions Code that says that you can be committed if you're a danger to yourself or others. And so we take meetings into the mental health facility, and the people there who came to the meetings because it was an activity, something to do, you know, like crafts. And they would show up at the meeting, and it was kind of like kindergarten. I became a facility coordinator, and I took meetings in there for 6 years. And it was different than this meeting. You kind of had to tell them, if you want to be in the meeting, we talk one at a time, and we keep our clothes on. I'm not kidding. Because these people were psychotic and medicated adults who were in deep denial about the fact that they were alcoholics. And that's, for me, that was such a gift. Because I don't know if any of those people ever got sober. But that's where I was going if I hadn't got sober. I would have been a wet brain. I have really good genes. My mom's 92. She has a little dementia. But, you know, I love her today. And I can tell her that every day and mean it. But I would have been locked up or, you know, wet brain. I wouldn't have been lucky enough to die. It's a terrible disease. And I had people try to tell me that it was a waste of time. People who didn't want to stay sober said, why do you go into that facility and you take those? They're not getting it, but I got it. And it was a great gift. I had another sponsor who taught me that the importance of being a double winner. She said, if you want to be a double winner, you have to go to the sister program, and you just go and you're Lisa. You're not Lisa an alcoholic, you're Lisa and you love an alcoholic. And I love lots of alcoholics, so I belong in the sister program. And I go there. And I go to a lot of other 12-step. I qualify for everything. I can, you know. I came to my morning, my home group is the morning attitude adjustment meeting that meets, and there are a lot of you here today. And yes! and I have two home groups, that group, and that group meets in the Kaiser second floor conference room. I probably shouldn't say this, should I? No, it's in the schedule. Second floor conference room. On Vandeveer in Grantville, and every day at 7 o'clock in the morning. And it's a gut level meeting, and I went there because I was having trouble in relationship, and I was getting ready to get out of another one. And it was me. I was in it. I was the problem. And I went to that meeting because I needed a sponsor, and a woman who I met at another meeting told me about that meeting, and I kept going to that meeting because to find her, and she was never there. So I kept going. Anyway, she eventually showed up, and now she's my sponsor. And she couldn't be here tonight, but I have more authentic relationships with my friends today, with my family, with myself, and with my higher power than I've ever had before. And I think it's, you know, because of God and groups like my home group. I have another home group That's the La Mesa Women's Meeting on Saturday morning at 9:30. Meets in the Senior Center. And I love all, I don't think I've ever been to a bad AA meeting. I remember going to AA with my first husband and thinking, what a bunch of losers. Why don't they just quit drinking? It's a problem. So I made it here a few years later, and I did not want to be here. I did not want to call myself an alcoholic. When I was, I think, about 2 years sober, I just retired from the state after 35 and a half years of state service, and I worked really hard in sobriety. One of the things I got to do was be a substance abuse assistance counselor in the Department of Forestry for a number of years. Broke my anonymity all over that department, and people still kept offering me a beer. I learned how to play golf in sobriety. I got to travel all over. I had been working, when I got sober, I forgot to tell you that part. I was working in the office of the Attorney General, living a really double life. You know, I was going to Bob's Club at night and working in the AG's office during the day. And I used to do lines off the pictures on the walls in the AG's office. And I was really... I should have been fired. In fact, the reason I'm here today is because John Vandekamp at that time was the Attorney General. What a blessed soul he is, because he was running for office, I think, probably. He wanted to be governor. And he was telling everybody that he was going to start drug testing all state employees. They still don't do it, but I got sober. Joke's on them. And that's, you know, I really have to thank, it's not, you know, I didn't come here by any, I don't come to any meeting out of any virtue. It's because I need to be here. And I need all of you, and, you know, I'm living sober as part of a fellowship that is, you know, we just finished with the 12th step in December, and it really is. The joy of living. Yay! I got cracked. You know, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it probably is. You guys don't have any problem. Just keep coming back. Thanks.